So, December 7th has a vital place in the annals of American history for two reasons. 1941, December 7th, was Pearl Harbor, when Japan attacked the United States, which essentially triggered the entry of the U.S. into the Second World War. December 7th, 2016, with slightly fewer geopolitical implications, I became a citizen of the United States, which is why it has named the Day of Infamy, so I'm told. Which was an arduous process. I had to get my biometric testing done. I had to learn American history, American law. I had to learn how to speak proper English, as they tested me. I had to learn how to write an English sentence. I had to prove that I actually loved my wife, which apparently I still have to do, even though I'm an American citizen already. I had to answer questions about what color toothbrush she uses. I don't know what color toothbrush I use, but I had to find out what she uses. And then following December 7th, I attained every right and every protection of every other American citizen. I have the right to vote, to freedom of expression, the right to bear arms. I have every other right, with one exception. What can I not do? I cannot be president. Turns out I can run for president. This was actually adjudicated to some degree by the Supreme Court just a couple of weeks ago in a different context. There's nothing that stops me running. There's nothing that stops anybody voting for me. I just can't hold the office. I can't be president of the United States. As of a month ago, I don't know what month we're in. What month are we in?
February.
As of 3 months ago, I could run for Congress. You have to be a citizen for 7 years to run for Congress, and you have to be a citizen for 9 years to run for the Senate. So I've got 2 more years till I can run for Senate, but never would I be able to run for president of the United States. As you can see in the middle of your sheet, in the yellow there, no person except a natural-born citizen or a citizen of the United States at the time of the adoption of the Constitution, and not having been around in the late 770s, I'm out on those grounds, shall be eligible to the office of president. And there are two other conditions listed here in the Constitution, which are you've got to be 35. Over 35, so I regret to say I do make the cut on those grounds, and you have to have been a resident of the United States for 14 years. They do not have to be consecutive, and they don't have to be the 14 years right before you run. Herbert Hoover became president, having only lived in the United States for 11 years. In advance of that, he was in London beforehand, so maybe I've got a chance. And the question is why? Why should someone who was not born a citizen not be able to be president of the United States? There are no limits in Israel that you have to have been born in Israel to be the president or the prime minister. There are no limits in England on who can be the prime minister. There are limits on who can be king. But that's none to do with whether you're a citizen or a subject. And the truth is, what I'd like to do over the few minutes we have together this morning is explore this question through the lens of Jewish thought. Because while some have tried to trace this limit in the Constitution to British common law, it is very hard to do because the king, you don't have to be born in England, you have to be born or related to the king. So they've tried to find the phrase natural born in English law, but it actually may be easier to tie it to Jewish law and biblical law, because there is a similar prohibition to those who immigrate to the Jewish body politic on becoming the leader. And this is where, for the few minutes ahead, we're going to break down the next few minutes into four pieces. But by way of introduction, I should note the laws of immigration are hard to find in halachic codes. But if I were to look, where would I look?
Gerus.
Say again?
Gerus.
Conversion. Exactly. Because it turns out that conversion is actually a pretty bad translation of the word gerut. It is an adoption of a Christian term for when someone joins a creed or a faith. I'll ask you a question. How do you become, and I'm not going to do a how-to, I guess, but how does one become a Christian? For most denominations, what does it involve?
Baptism.
So that's for certain strands of Catholicism, a baptism is required. But really, what is required? You just have to change your belief. I'm not going to. But I could literally this second convert to Christianity. I could just, I mean, it would ruin YU's morning if I announced right now. Yeah, we'll edit this bit in the recording out. But I could right now make a declaration that I changed my creed, and that's it. What if somebody stands up and say, I believe in Judaism? Are they Jewish?
No.
Why not? They've changed that. They've converted their creed. What is required?
Action.
So they say, I'll do 14 push-ups. I'll shake a lulav. I'll light candles. I'll put on tefillin. I'll do whatever you want me to do. It doesn't matter. Doesn't matter what rituals you observe. Doesn't matter what prayers you say. Doesn't matter what creed you believe. What is required for you to become a member of the Jewish people?
Commitment to mitzvot.
Commitment to mitzvot. I commit to mitzvot. I change my creed. I'll do it all. So circumcision is required, mikveh. So what happens if they come and say, I just came from the mikveh, I've changed my creed, I'll accept all the mitzvot, still? There has to be a bet din. And what do we call that in English? The immigration court. Because as I just said, you're not joining the Jewish faith. What are you joining?
People.
The Jewish people. I had a meeting on October 5th. With somebody who is interested in conversion. You know, it's weird to call it immigration, even if that is the better translation. And one of the things that you speak about is, this is not about belief. I deeply want you right now, whether you want to be Jewish or not, I want you to believe that there is one God. We have a deep faith that we want all of humanity to accept monotheism. We believe that is the most redemptive way to live. We believe it is a cosmic truth. And that's irrespective of which expression to that faith you choose. You can be a redeemed human being and not be Jewish. Everyone in universally in the Jewish creed believes that. What would be required for you to convert, I say to this person, is you have to identify with the Jewish body politic, with the Jewish story. You have to absorb Jewish history as your history. And on October 5th, you know, it feels odd, you know, I say you have to know. I grew up in Europe, in London, where I had encounters with anti-Semitism all the time. I imagine most, maybe not all, but I imagine most of you, if you grew up in the United States, in New York, on the whole, didn't have personal encounters with anti-Semitic rhetoric or name-calling generally before October 7th. And it felt weird to say, you have to know, it's not easy to be a Jew. You can get picked on, you can get called names. Historically, we've been persecuted and marginalized. I told them stories when I was growing up, and you get called all sorts of things all the time, and that was just my sisters. And then you go outside and you get called all sorts of things in public. And I said that part of what would be required to become Jewish is not about faith. You could on the spot right now change your faith, and that doesn't make you Jewish. You could right now come to synagogue and pray. You could do all the rituals. It doesn't make you Jewish. It is a political transformation. You are immigrating to a virtual body politic, where you are now a citizen, that are bound by certain rules, and you have certain rights and protections, and we as a people will have obligations to you that we do not have right now. And you will have obligations to somebody else. If somebody in Australia becomes needy, you will have an obligation. It's part of that body politic to support them. And this is a transformation of what Geirut means. It does not mean to convert. It essentially means to immigrate. And there are wants. One does immigrate to the Jewish body politic. Are there any limits, or are you equal like every other citizen? Equal. Any exceptions?
Sure.
Can't become king. Okay, so that's exactly where we're going to come to. Well, I can't be a Kohen or a Levi. So that's exception. So there are limits on some marriage possibilities, which also apply to other members of the Jewish people, so it's not unique to somebody. Say again?
You don't have a chelek in Eretz Yisrael.
So you don't naturally have a chelek in Eretz Yisrael that have to be bequeathed to you. It's also an unusual turn. What mitzvah could, is it impossible for somebody to fulfill in a technical way?
Honoring your parents.
It's a strange turn that when one immigrates into, and this is again part of the political shift, your identity is completely remade. refashioned. In fact, what's the halachic phrase? Right. Kol ger shenit gayer, every convert who converts, any immigrant who immigrates, is like a newborn child. Katan shenola dami, which means you get your biological links are completely reforged. You are reimplanted into a new identity. And there are questions about whether you owe allegiance to your biological parents. And in conversation with people who have been through conversion, I have a family member who went through conversion. There are questions about whether you should, the question, should I respect my biological parents? It's like, well, you should respect all human beings and they've done a lot for you. You should have gratitude for people. So it makes a lot of sense. Strictly speaking, does the application of Kiudo Va'em apply? Technically, the answer is no. Technically, somebody who converts, if their sibling converts, legally, they can marry each other because they're not related anymore in a pure legal sense. So on the whole, there are no exceptions, apart from maybe not being able to honor your parents, which some members of the Jewish people are unable to do if they lose their parents in some sense. But there is this one law that you can't become king. And this is, if you look in the middle, right under the yellow box, this is a verse from Dvarim. Som tasim alach ha-melech, you shall appoint for yourself a king, asher yivcha Hashem alokecha bo, that the Lord your God will choose me. Kerev achecha, has to be from among your brethren. Tasim alach ha-melech, lo tuchol latet alecha ish nachri, you cannot have a foreign person, asher lo achicha, who is not one of your brothers, rule over you. And the question I want to answer, so by the end of our time together, which will be not too long, because I want to make sure you enjoy President's Day, I want us to be able to leave with the takeaway that you asked a question and I gave an answer. And the question is, why can I never be president? Or why can an immigrant never be king in the Jewish context? And I'll give you an answer as to why that might be. But along the way, I'd like to build the case into four pieces. So the first is going to be a little bit of background in terms of the value. What is the Jewish attitude to immigrants? And this is not a question about American immigration or policies around contemporary politics. That will shelve because, as I said, I want us to enjoy President's Day and not get into controversial waters. And policy questions are not the point. And we could actually devote a huge amount of time as to what Judaism would have to say about immigration policies. Do we recruit immigrants? If we're speaking of conversion or gerim as immigrants, does Jewish policy seek to recruit immigrants?
No.
Has that universally been the case?
No.
Okay, so we've got two no's in a row. That's good. So generally, the Jewish attitude is we don't recruit. And in fact, when you meet somebody interested in conversion for the first time, halacha on the book suggests, you said, trust me, you don't. Trust me, I'm telling you. You know, gefilte fish is just not worth it. And if you're desperate, just go and buy some. But historically, there were moments where the Jewish body politic did recruit members during the age of the Second Temple period. The rabbis debate this. Avram was a recruit or sought recruits, as we say, that he converted a number to his outlook. In fact, there is one view in the Gemara that suggests diaspora itself was a divinely, providentially designed recruitment mechanism so that we go throughout the world and that we find new adherents to the Jewish body politic to bring them back. There's another view, which is slightly less optimistic, that says it's just so that if the other nations of the world seek to destroy us, they can't destroy us all at the same time because we spread out. So that's two different Jewish attitudes on the page in the Talmud. So recruitment is one question, but I want to leave that to the side. The processes of immigration is another question. As I said, to become an American, I had to learn, they actually gave me the questions and the answers, which was very helpful. 100 questions and 100 answers about American history, law, culture, politics. I had to learn the language. So when you learn to become Jewish and immigrate, what do you have to know? How do you have to be able to read Hebrew, understand Hebrew? Do you have to know all the prayers? Do you have to know all the mitzvot? Because there are a lot of people who are already members of the Jewish people who don't know all those mitzvot, at which point I would say, yeah, there are a lot of Americans who don't know the stuff I had to learn about America to become an American. So we're going to shelve those questions and ask, what is the Jewish attitude towards those who have already immigrated, to those who have been through the process of Geirut? To love them, you can't discriminate. So that's going to be step one. Step two is going to be, does that value that we are to love the immigrant, does that sit in tension, or does that clash with this principle they cannot serve as the leader, as the king? Then we'll explore a couple of quick case studies where this question comes up in contemporary Jewish life as well. And then we'll finish with a conclusion, part four, to answer the question we're posing, which is why they cannot serve and why I cannot be president, to make it personal. So phase one, attitudes towards those who've already immigrated. At the top of the page on page one, there's a couple of verses from Dvarim, where Moses turns to the Jewish people and he says, there's only one thing God needs from you. Atah Yisrael, Mashem Elokecha, Sha'al Mimecha. What is it that God asks from you? Ki'im li'yirat Hashem Elokecha, le'lecha b'tuchol d'rachav. The only thing God wants from you, fear him and follow in his ways. And as Dean Schechter said, okay, that's easy enough, I guess. That's quite hard, but that's the one thing God wants from you, to fear him and follow in his ways. Ki Hashem Elokecha. And now let's see how God is described. What are the character traits that define the being to whom we turn in awe and reverence? God is the God of gods, the Lord of lords. Sounds familiar. Great, awesome, heroic, powerful. Who does not favor, does not accept bribes. Who does justice for the orphan and for the widow. Who loves, sometimes it's translated as the stranger, which is a way of saying somebody who comes from abroad. Immigrant is a very guttural word. It doesn't sound quite poetic. It's not something that the King James translators would have used. So they say the stranger. But in contemporary terms, that's not really a way. That's almost a pejorative to say, well, they're kind of strange. But when we say love the stranger, it means love the immigrant, the foreign-born. That's how Rashi explains it. Someone haba mimidina acheret, someone who's come from another. The basic premise of this year is I want everyone to love me in America. That's basically what this is. And I should note as a side point that for those of you familiar with the Penine Halacha or of Eliezer Melamed, or anyone familiar with the Chashuke Chemed or of Zilberstein, they suggest that there is a biblical obligation to love people who have relocated. The Penina Halacha of Melamed in Israel says there is an obligation on the part of native-born Israelis to love Olim. It's not just a good policy to encourage Nefesh b'Nefesh, but actually in the same way you've got an obligation to love the ger, the stranger, if somebody has relocated and uprooted from everything they know, it is not easy to live in a new place. And this is not confessional on my part. And I should say I've only experienced incredibly warm welcome in this country from the Jewish community and beyond. But it is not easy to relocate and leave behind your family and not be surrounded by the memories of your childhood and the memories of your grandparents and the history of your personal family. And there is an obligation to love them and welcome them in new ways. And Olim have filled that role in some way. Even though they haven't converted, they have immigrated in that sense. So God is described as an ohev ger, one who loves the stranger, latet lo lechem asimla, to give them bread and to give them clothing. Va'ahav demet ha-ger, and you, says Moses, when he says there's only one thing you need to know, follow God's ways, which involves dispensing justice for the orphan and the widow, loving the stranger, and reminding us, va'ahav demet ha-ger, love the stranger, gerim ayitem v'mitzrayim, because you were gerim in Egypt. And if we think gerim means converts to another religion, what does that mean we were gerim in the land of Egypt? Did we convert in the land of Egypt?
No.
Thank you for falling into that trap. So there are suggestions that Orach Haim, among others, say this is proof that we followed idolatry and we actually did lose our way religiously. But yes, the Pshat Rashi and Eli and many of the commentators who follow Eli take the view that we were immigrants, we were foreign, and we were mistreated, and through that experience, we should dispense care. So that's level one from Tanakh. But then we're going to look very briefly in Chazal in the next box for the attitude towards those who immigrate or convert to Judaism. Chaviv and Gerim, that should be clear, right at the beginning of the second box. Those who immigrate to Judaism are beloved. Chaviv means to express and embrace in love. And then we won't read it all inside. The question is addressed as to why Avraham didn't have his Brit Milah until he was 99. When did God first reach out to Avram? How old was he?
75,
let's say. So beginning of Lech Lecha, end of Parashat Noach, the age of 75, he's summoned to go on this journey. He doesn't have Brit Milah until he's 99. Why the wait? Couldn't get a caterer. That's a major problem. Had to wait till he could find a good caterer. And then that's the real reason. What's the fake reason why he had to wait? So there are a few different readings. Rav Shimshon Raphael Hirsch actually suggests that he had to kind of morally perfect himself as a human being before he morally perfected himself as a Jew. But the Medrash here in the Mechelta Rabbi Shmuel suggests that actually this was a policy issue. If Avram had his Brit Milah at the age of 20 or 30, that may dissuade people in their 50s, 60s, or 70s and think, I've kind of missed the boat on joining this people. The cutoff, forgive the turn of phrase, is... Sorry, we were blessed to have a son about 5 weeks ago, so I've been through all the jokes. So thank you very much. I haven't slept in 7 weeks. I haven't slept in 8 years. I mean. But putting that aside... So the cutoff you might think would be at 20 or 30. So Avram waits till he's 99. Look in the bold at the end of that box. Shelo linol delet b'fnei hagerim ba'im, so as not to close the door on future immigrants or future converts. So that's the suggestion that Avram had to wait 25 years, 24 years. He had to wait until he was 99, until he could form a covenant with God for one reason. So that never in the future should anybody have any hesitation at the age of 95 to say, I want to change my allegiance. I want to immigrate. And this is not a pitch for Nefesh B'Nefesh, but it's never too late. If you want to uproot yourself, it's very difficult. And you say, look, I'm stuck in my ways. I'm already, you know, I'm done. Avram didn't have his Brit Milah until he was 99. Still found a good caterer. You can do it anytime. So that's box number two from Chazal. Box number three, we won't read it all inside. This is Maimonides, the Rambam. He received a letter in the last decades of his life. Having already fled from Cordoba, Spain, escaped from Fez, Mexico, had been forced to leave Israel after 6 months, and made his way to Egypt, where he became Reis al-Yehud, which means the head of the Jews. And he got a letter from a young man called Ovadia, who we can assume original name was Abdullah, because he converted from Islam to Judaism, and Abdullah is the Arabic for Ovadia, which means the servant of God, Eved Ullah, or Allah. So he writes as Ovadia, and he says, I was getting up to the Amud to daven and lead the shul. And you know what it's like in shul. You get up to the Amud, and you know, people start heckling you. So somebody started heckling and said, well, actually, Ovadia, you're a convert. You can't lead. He said, why not? Everyone said there's no exceptions. He said, well, how are you going to stand up and say, Elokeinu v'Elokei Avotenu, our God and the God of our fathers? It's not your fathers. And he was obviously upset by this, but he wrote to Maimonides and he said, the question sounds like a question. What am I meant to do with this? And it's not the first time this question was raised. This question comes up already in the Talmud in the context of, anyone know what declaration do we make? Bikurim, Seder night is when we say, Avi Aramed Ami, that my father was a wandering Aramean. Can somebody who has immigrated say that? My father was a wandering Aramean. And there's a debate in the Gemara as to that. But the Rambam addresses this. And he says, Avram is your father. It's true biologically, you're not a descendant of Avraham. But think about what Avram did. He dislocated himself for the purpose of faith. He followed the call of God away from his family, away from his culture, away from his native life in search of truth and justice and integrity. So you are the child of Avraham. So you can say that. And then he says, and don't worry if you think biologically you're not related to them. He says, Al yehi yichusach kal ba'inacha, and don't start thinking that your yichus is not that good, because it's true. Im anachnu mityachasim l'Avraham Yitzchak Yaakov, we are the children of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, but what about you? What's your yichus? Ata mityaches l'misha ama v'haya ha'olam. You're related to God. You're God's child. So if you think, you know, well, you're the child of Avram, Isaac, yeah, and they're human, they're fallible, they're full of flaws, they make mistakes. You're the child of God. By the way, what is the proof that somebody who converts is a child of God? Anyone know there is a case of a immigrant / convert where Chazal say God picked their name to make this point? Begins with Bat and ends with Yah. All right, fine. Begins with Bit and it ends with Ya. Bitya, or Batya, as sometimes she's referred to, the woman who found Moses. And the Gemara says that you treated Moses as your child, God's going to treat you as his child, and got the name. And the Gemara suggests that the attitude we have to converts. And then the Rambam goes on to say that, and not only should you not think badly about yourself because you're not descendant of this biological tree, but you should know that as Jews, as native citizens, we have obligations to you that we have to nobody else. We have the obligation, what obligations do we have to our parents naturally? What does the Torah say we have to do? Honor and respect. What does it not say we have to do to our parents? Does not tell us we have to love our parents. We just have to do what they say. And that's what I tell my kids every day. You don't have to love me, you just have to do what I say. What obligation do we have to prophets? We have to listen. Do we have to love them? No. And the Rambam says, you can listen, you can honor, you can respect without loving. And what we're commanded to do for the immigrant or the convert is le'ehov et hager, to love converts. And there's only, in addition to v'ahavta l'recha kamocha, the general obligation to love one's fellow citizen, there's an additional one to love the ger. And in terms of who is pinpointed for love, there's only two. The ger and v'ahavta Hashem Elokecha, love the Lord your God. So not only are you biologically connected to God, we have to treat you in the same way that we're only commanded to treat God. And I should know, so that we've got now a chain of history from Tanakh, Chazal, Maimonides, medieval period. I'll note anecdotally, because I don't want to pretend that it's not real, in circles where there are CVs for the purposes of Shidduchim, it can sometimes be very difficult for people who've converted, because people do say, well, what about your Yichas? I don't know, and I'm worried, etc., etc. And it's said anecdotally in the name of Rav Elyashiv, someone came to Rav Elyashiv and said, I've been suggested to match up with somebody who is converted. Should I, you know, reject it just without knowing anything? Should I just reject it because it's not ideal? And Rav Elyashiv supposedly said, well, actually, this is fantastic, because if you do end up being a good match and you do end up marrying them and loving them, you get to fulfill an extra mitzvah every single day. Because not only do you love your spouse, but v'ahavtem et hager. You get to fulfill the mitzvah of ahavat hager every single day. So it's actually a wonderful opportunity for you to fulfill more mitzvot in your life. So what we've established now, part one, and we're obviously going to have to accelerate the pace here. Part one is attitude to those who have immigrated to the Jewish people. Those who have converted is unconditional love. We have an obligation. And as I said, this applies not only to those who have converted, but this is kind of broadly applied in Jewish thought to those who have come from a foreign place, to Olim. I'll also note the Chashuke Chemed, Rav Zilberstein discusses if somebody's visiting a shul, you know, the common case, someone comes into a shul, sits in a seat, and you go up to them and say, welcome! No, you say, you're in my seat, get out. So he says, if you come into shul, and this case comes up, he says, I come to shul, and I'm asking you, Rav Zilberstein, this is my chair. I don't want to be that guy. I don't want to be, but you should know that this is a seat that my grandfather sat in and my father sat in, and this is where I have kavana. If I'm not sitting there, I'm going to feel off kilter the whole service, and I'm not going to be rude. I'm not going to say, hey, get out. I'm going to say, welcome, it's good to see you. It's like, please come sit with me. I just want you to know this is my family seat. I'd love for you to sit next to me, but can I sit in my seat? That's how I would do it. Can I do that, or should I not move that? And Rav Zilberstein says, well, the mitzvah of ahavtem et hager, broadly applied, means somebody who's not in their native place is going to be naturally uncomfortable. And we have an obligation to go out of our way to suppress our own needs, to make them feel embraced, seen, and loved. And in that case, you should suppress your own need, fill off kilter for the whole of davening, because they are the equivalent of the ger in their circumstance. They're an outsider to a community, and you should feel free to embrace them and kind of feel a little uncomfortable, and that's your obligation. So, point number one, we have an obligation to love the immigrant. Point number two, which we've already illustrated, there is a law on the books that I can never be president. I'm really angry about it. And not only can I never be president, but somebody who is a ger cannot be king. And if you look inside, in the second gray box after the yellow, Kiddushin, there's a Gemara, which describes a case where somebody who had converted was having a debate with a local sage about who was going to take responsibility for a local issue. It's not clear whether this was dispensing tzedakah or organizing the local fete. Is that a thing in America? A fete? A fair? A local fair? There was something they were debating, and they went to Rav Yosef and said, Rav Yosef, who should lead? Both thinking, I'm more qualified, I'm better positioned to have this position. And his response was, Second line, Tanena at the end, Semdasimalacha Melech Mekerachecha, you have to appoint a king from among your people. Kol Mesimot, Shaltam Esim. Any position of authority, he says, not just the king, any position of authority, Lo Yal Mekerachecha has to be native born citizen. It's now been radically expanded. I thought it was just the king, I thought I couldn't run for president. Imagine now being told, no, actually, you can't hold any office at all. You can't run for mayor, you can't run for a seat on the county board, you can't run for Senate or Congress, you can't run for anything. And if you look in Maimonides in the next book, the figure who just told us that we have to love the immigrant like we love God, who is related to God, Ein ma'amidim melech mikal gerim, it says you can't appoint a king from a line of converts. Afilu acha kama dorot, even after many generations, actually tell me Yisrael, until they have a Jewish mother. That's a consideration. As he then he quotes the verse, and then in bold, "V'lo malchut bilvad," and not only kingship, "L'chol sararot should be Israel," but any position of sarara, what's called authority, they can't occupy in the Jewish people. And that sounds incredibly broad. What would you consider under authority? And I'll ask. Say again. President of a shul. I was going to say maybe I put myself in a difficult position. What about the rabbi? Is a rabbi a position of authority? Any of you heard of Modi? Anyone heard of the comedian Modi?
Yeah.
Anyone seen his bit about the difference between Ashkenaz and Sfarad attitude to their rabbis? Sfaradi rabbi have Sfarad, they've got authority, Ashkenazim. Who's this at the board meeting? Is that just the rabbi? Get him out. Yeah. What does he think he's doing? So there's an interesting question to be raised about cultural roles played by these figures. But any position of authority is how it comes up. And we've got now onto, that's point two. So let's do phase three. So again, point one was, the background value, which is we have an obligation to embrace in abject love someone who uproots themselves and immigrates to the Jewish people, the stranger. Point two, they are barred not just from kingship or queenship and monarchy, they're barred from any position of authority. Does that sound good? Sound like love? So we don't want you in charge of anything. Sounds like we don't trust you. Sounds like you're barred, disqualified. You can't, in American law, you have to be 35. We assume you're too immature if you're not. You have to have lived here for 14 years. We assume you're not connected to the people and you're not born here. It also sounds very pejorative. So how do we square those two things? The value that we have to embrace here with love and then this bar on authority. Yeah.
I think it means you can't impose your authority.
What do you mean?
Meaning if people agree that person should be the authority. For example, can't be a diet. But if somebody comes with your care, somebody, two people come to you and say, hey, could you educate our dispute, then they're acceptable to be a diet.
Right, meaning extrajudicially maybe you can serve this position if people select for you. But so are you saying that if we had a democratic vote, they could be king? We say, let's elect you.
Mutzak Hall does work in other situations.
No, meaning, for example, let's just assume a Rebbe Bishul is a position of authority.
Let's assume that. It's not true, but let's assume.
People of the shul are masking that person could be the wrong, but that's the best candidate, then presumably you can keep your position.
Thank you. So this is going to be our first case study. One solution. That might be one carve-out, which is quite a big carve-out, which is if people want it. Makes them like, oh, well, that's all defunct. So in the United States, if you're born abroad, you can't run unless people want you. In fact, somebody tried to pass legislation in Congress to this effect. The Republican Party in the late 1990s, I'm told, wanted to change the Constitution to say if it's an acceptable person to the public, they should be able to run. For whom?
Kissinger?
Nope. Yes, I'll be back. Arnold Schwarzenegger, he was a popular Republican governor of California, and they wanted him to. They thought he would get, like Reagan, he would be a popular, broad figure to the public. It didn't pass. So I still can't be president. What can you do? So a couple of case studies quickly. Number one, third box up from the bottom, we've got the chain of tradition in Pirkei Avot. From the beginning, it goes from Moshe to Yeshua to the Kadesh to Nevi'im all the way through. And then we get to Shemaya and Avtalion. Who are Shemaya and Avtalion?
They were either descendants from Gerim or...
So if you have a look in the Bar Tanura, in that box, he says, Geri Tzedek Hayu. They were converts. Geri Tzedek as opposed to Ger Toshav, which is... So we could, again, spend a lot of time on these details. Anyone familiar with the concept of Ger Toshav? So a Ger Toshav is somebody... A resident alien. Anyone familiar with the term resident alien? So before I became a citizen, I was not just an Englishman or a Brit. I also had something in my pocket. A green card. I was a permanent resident. So it turns out in Jewish law, there is also a concept of intermediate status, where you're not Jewish, but you're allowed to be part of the body politic. And this is a ger toshav, where you come before a court, the immigration court or the Beit Din, and you say, I accept the Shiva Mitzvahs B'nai Noach. They're really bound by those. All human beings are bound by these. But if you come to a court and you accept them upon yourselves, you can live in the Jewish territory, in the Jewish body politic. You're a virtual member of the people. So that exists. But this is Geri Tzedek. They weren't just Geri Toshav. They were full converts, is what we say, full immigrants. Mibnei Banav Shel Sancheiriv. Not only were Shammai Natavion converts, they were descendants of Sancheiriv, who is the ancient equivalent to which modern figure, if you were to pick one? Say again? Hitler. Yeah, basically. He is the one who came in and wiped out the first temple, exiled, scattered, slaughtered, and destroyed everything about Jewish life from the age of Solomon in fundamental ways. And they are his descendants. So they were converts and descendants of Sancheiriv. So we'll put aside the question of descendants of Sancheiriv. They were converts. How can it be? They're in a position of authority. So there are two answers. The first, Tosfot Yom Tov suggests from the Maharal, is that they weren't actually immigrants or converts themselves, that they come from a line of converts, but their mother was Jewish. Okay, so he's got a way to kind of resolve that issue. But the Magen Avot of the Rashbates takes the view that, no, they were converts, but they were also the best people for the job. And if the person who is most qualified for the job, and there is no native citizen who's got the same qualifications that exist, you can take the immigrant. So maybe you could make that argument, you run for president, and you say, have you seen the field? I'm the only one who's not 85 who's running for president. So maybe I should be able to take the position. So no, the Constitution bars you. We say, no, but the carve-out is, that's only if there's no one available in the country. There's only 345 million people here, and I'm the only one who can do it. So the Rashbetz thinks that's the argument. Shammai Natalion were the most suitable candidates for the position, so there's a carve-out for that. And if you turn over onto page 2, again, we won't read it all inside, but the top three boxes are contemporary cases asking questions about roles of authority. One is, there was a incredibly well-qualified woman who was approached to be a menahelet, or a head of school, for a girls' school. And they said, she's talented, she's qualified, she's charming, she is just perfect for the post, and we've done an exhaustive search. She is the best for this position. Can we employ her as a head of school because she converted? And even asking the question, does that not feel like against the grain of that value that you have to embrace with love this person? Sounds exclusive. And his answer in the top of the box, Tshuva van Hagar of an incredibly influential halachis in Yerushalayim, he takes the view that this is not public office. And when there is a bar for this immigrant to serve, it is only for something which is what he calls minui al hatzibur, which is a public office, a mayor, a governor, a president. But this is a private institution who's trying to employ somebody to fill a role, to carve out, not a problem. The next box, he gets asked the question, what about a Rosh Yeshiva? Can somebody serve as a Rosh Yeshiva? And this is where he says, yes, Rosh Yeshiva don't have authority. But he doesn't mean it tongue in cheek. What he means is, what is the job of a Rosh Yeshiva, ultimately? What is your teaching? You're not there to formulate policies. And the yeshiva I was in Israel, on the whole, that tended to be true. We actually, by the end of my time there, I was 3 years in Yeshiva Har Etzion in Gush, we had four Rosh Yeshiva by the end. So they clearly weren't singular decision makers. It was kind of a panel. And they had a president of the institution. And Rav Lichtenstein, who was the most senior of the Rosh Yeshiva, he wasn't really a policy maker. He advised, they consulted, but he didn't see himself as like, I'm in charge. I'm the head teacher. It's the difference between maybe the dean of an institute and the president of an institute or the senior lecturer of an institute. Or you think about Yeshiva University. Who's got, maybe you don't answer this. I was going to say, who's got more power, President Berman or Herschel Schechter? But don't answer that. Now I'm in trouble. So the point being, technically speaking, a Rosh Yeshiva is not endowed with authority. They may hold sway, But that's not their role. Their role is to teach and to morally inform the public. So that's his view, Tshuva Nahagot, on Rosh Hashanah. He says, what about a rabbi? And this is where it does become culturally different, because there are some places where rabbis do hold authority. They are the policymakers of their shuls. So you have a president, but the president defers to the rabbi in everything. And personally, in positions I've had, that is not the view I've taken or the role I've had. I tend not to attend board meetings, and I let the president preside and make decisions. And, I'm happy to be consulted for when there's a religious or moral question, but I'm not involved in how the funds are spent, apart from, you know, on me. I'm very involved in that. Otherwise, I see my view as a moral or religious voice, not a president. But his view is that sometimes when rabbis do have authority, they do make decisions about where the funds go and where people, how they join, how the kind of institution operates. He says maybe it is better that somebody who's converted does not have that position, unless there is nobody else who's qualified. If you do an exhaustive search and they're the only one who's qualified, you can hire them. But otherwise, he suggests maybe they take a different name and they call themselves a Morei Tzedek or a Skan instead of the rabbi. And then he adds in these last three lines in that second box, he says, and when you are rejecting them from this post, you have to be very careful not to say that we think you're inferior, that you're being excluded, as he puts it in bold here. V'lo mipnei b'chitutam, not because you are less than, lo makab l'motam, we don't accept you, ela din Torah, it is just, this is the law. As somebody intimated earlier, I can never be a Kohen. The reason I didn't come for 9:30, I would have been here for Din Shechter, I had to be at a bar mitzvah at my shul. It was a Sephardi bar mitzvah, which started at 8:30, so they're finishing about now. And they had Birchat Kohanim this morning. I wish I could have been up there, you know, doing the live life and prosper. Oh, yeah, Birchat Kohanim. Live long and prosper move. I'm out. That's just the law. So he says that if somebody's being rejected on the grounds that they are not native born, you shouldn't say, you know, we're suspicious. It's just the law. That's what his suggestion is. Naturally, we've got an obligation to love you. And there are lots of roles you can hold, just not this one. That's his suggestion. Rav Moshe, in the next box, also addresses this question, and he begins, and we'll just read this opening line, L'ma'aseh yesh l'de'a. In practice, he says, you have to know, Shehamitzvah shel v'ahavtem et hager, the obligation to love the convert, machayevet otanu l'karvam, it obligates us to bring them in, to embrace them, to find ways for them to serve. U'lahakel b'chol inyonim ha'elu. We have an obligation to be lenient. There are a few areas of Jewish life where we have an obligation to be lenient. And we know when one realm of Jewish life comes up, unfortunately, regularly, where we are as lenient as possible. Yeah. So when it comes to Gittin, we try to be lenient, that's true. When else? It doesn't come up that often in kind of public, it's built in. Aguna, we try to be. So these are kind of public policy we try to be, Mako. When it comes to Avelos, it's enshrined in the code of law. If any of you have ever had a situation in the community or personally when somebody has lost a loved one during Chol HaMoed, Sukkot or Pesach, you may find that there's only 6 days Shiva, which seems odd because it's called Shiva, which means seven. So why are there only 6 days? And that's because there's a debate about whether the second day of Yom Tov counts for first day. And in Hilchos Avelos, we always go Lahakel. So we say that first day, even though nobody's shitting Shiva, you are in shul. And we're not doing Avelos yet, we count that as the first day, so there's only 6 days. We're constantly making as much as possible with Avelos and other areas. So he says, here's another area. When it comes to loving the ger, you have to try to be as makel as possible. And he finds a way, although he does say, oddly enough, so we can find a way for them to be a rabbi, but what should we try for someone who's converted not to do on the whole? And this is not what you'd expect when it comes first to mind. So it's being a mashkiach. Because mashkichim have power. They can put down rules and say, that is treif. I'm shutting you down. You exhibit power. Rabbis can often not do that. You can't say, I'm shutting this joint down. Say, very nice, we're shutting you down. Bye-bye. But if you're a mashkich and you say it's treif, that's it. That's the final word. So he suggests that maybe in that area it's difficult, but elsewhere it's not a problem. So either way, we've now done three out of our four steps. So we're now at our final step. We've addressed the initial value that we have to love the ger. We've addressed the second point, which is that seems to be in tension with this rule that they can't serve in public office. We then looked at some case studies where this is not an abstract rule on the books, it isn't in practice. It's in practice all the time. Shemaim Venatavia of Talion, we had that case where we had various defensive of how they could have that role. We had the question from the Tshuvas van Hagot about whether they could be a rabbi, a Rosh Hashiva, whether they could serve as a head of school, Rav Moshe Mashkiach. So we've had contemporary cases where this comes up. And now we're going to come to the final question, which is, it seems to be, the bottom word is, there are exclusions. There are bans. I still cannot be president. And why should I not feel rejected by the American people? Why should I not feel judged by the founding fathers who said, you're not born here, you can never run? I am unapologetically a proud, proud American. I think this country is, in the last 1,500 years, the best political invention on earth. And not only because it is premised on the biblical teachings that the founding fathers drew their inspiration from, not only because it is the first secular country in human history that welcomed Jews with open arms and said, we want you to flourish here and there will be no prejudice held against you in law or otherwise. It is a country, one nation under God, that values liberty, dignity, humanity, freedom enshrined in its code, which is deeply inflected by religion. In the Declaration of Independence, it says we hold these truths to be self-evident, that God gives every human being the rights to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Why should I not feel rejected that says you can never run to be president? Why not? In fact, many immigrants are more patriotic than native-born people. I feel so grateful and so loved, having grown up, and again, I know the last few months have maybe inflected this differently, but I grew up with regular insults being thrown at me, not just by my sisters and my friends at school, but many times anti-Semitic verbal abuse was pretty regular. You know, you'd be people walking past go, a Jew. And I say, bless you. And then you say, bless you, until you realize that actually they weren't sneezing. Or I was punched in the head. Somebody stole my bike once. A group of us went to the movie theater, a group of friends and I. And on the bus, people were walking around saying, dirty Jew. And again, it wasn't grown-ups. They were kids. They were getting it from somewhere. But I came here, and there was never a point in New York, again, until the last few months, where I thought if I felt in danger, taking my kippah off would make a difference. If I was on the subway at 2 a.m. and someone was going to, like, be, it wasn't because of my kippah, it's because I was sitting alone on the subway at 2 a.m. Now I know people are feeling a lot more conscientious and feel like they have to look over their shoulder a little bit because you feel identified or attached. That was not the case. So why should I not feel rejected by the United States? Why should a convert not feel rejected by Judaism? So in the last 3 minutes, there are three boxes here at the bottom to address the question of why. What is the reason that somebody who is an immigrant cannot be king, cannot be president? Why a ger cannot have position of authority? So explanation number one from the Sefer HaChinuch, we're not going to read it all inside. He says, we'll read some of it inside. He says, Shoresh HaMitzvah Yadu. He says that the root of this mitzvah is understood. You have to be native-born Jew, Shem Rachmanim b'nei Rachmanim, because the Jewish character is compassionate and merciful. Now, this sounds like it's quite attached to genetics, suggesting that we inherit compassion. You know, you could read that with a different gloss to suggest that generation after generation after generation after generation, we've been raised to love and have compassion. And to some degree, I don't want to be too newsy in terms of the inflection we see. Some of the reason we just can't fathom the behavior from the other side since October 7th is just, how can you be that way? How can you treat other human beings like that? Like, and it's not like we've been living on cloud nine. We've received the brunt of the most horrific maltreatment of human beings. And yet as a people, we haven't suggested we should start going around doing stuff to people. That's not who we are. Even though we've been in a position of being squashed by people in power. And the suggestion here is that there is a inherited value that has been transmuted over history for compassion, and we want people in power to be people of compassion. As a side note, he adds the second line. He says, "A mishorash mitzvah," and from the root of this, you can also equate a truth that I think was the calling card of one of the major parties in America in the 1990s. And when I what it was two words when it comes, I think it was during the Clinton era, the Republican Party would say, "What's the most important thing about presidential candidates?"
Integrity.
Character matters. That was the call. Character matters. And it's not just somebody with the qualifications. It's not just somebody who has the administrative power. We want someone with good character. And this is what the Sefer HaChinuch suggests you can learn from here, is that people in power, character matters. And that's why we say native born. Because we're assuming, and again, in the ancient world, if you weren't native born Jews, where were you from? Or what culture were you from? Mesopotamia, Greece, Egypt, Rome. You were from cultures that thought you can sacrifice children, kill your neighbor, exploit the poor, abuse women without consequence. Those were the assumptions. So if you're coming in, we have to show you love. We have to embrace you. But there are limits, says the Sefer HaChinuch, because we're worried about what it takes generations to build up into the body politic in terms of values. The second box, under the question marks of Penina Halachar of Malamud, we noted, he gives three different pragmatic reasons why somebody in power might want to be native born. Number one, he says, when you're in power, you have an obligation to inspire the people and lead them with a moral vision. And anybody who's ever been in a position of power, of authority, it's a very stressful place to be. You have decisions at your desk every moment of every day with massive consequences. I mean, this is not a good example, but I can only speak from personal experience. October 7th, I'm sure we all know where we were. I was in shul Shabbos morning. I saw somebody crying in the hallway. As a rabbi, it's very hard to go to the bathroom Shabbos morning because you've got a lot of obligations. You've got the Misha Berach, you've got the Avinu Shabbat Shemaim, you've got to be there for the lay. So Haftorah, everyone thinks I'm going to the Kiddush Club. I'm not going to the Kiddush Club. But during the Haftorah, I have a small window. So I went out to the hallway, I saw somebody crying, and I said, "Everything okay?" And they said, "No." And then they started saying, it's terrible what's going on. Israel has been attacked from sea, from air, and I thought I was going through some sort of hallucination, and I didn't know what was happening. And my first thought was, in about 2 minutes, I've got the prayer for the state of Israel, and this is not just about how do I process this for myself. What am I saying to the room? How am I meant to frame this? How am I meant to speak about this? How am I meant to feel it? How do I feel? Is it true? Is this person? And then they looked at me and said, unless it's a joke, someone just told me. So I'm now thinking, is it true? Is it not true? So again, I'm not in a position of major power, and I can't even imagine what it's like to be in. I mean, I'm sure many of us have that image in our mind of George Bush on the morning of 9/11, when that picture of him in the school, when you can see someone whispering in his ear that the Twin Towers have been hit, and you see his face. Like, what do I say to the people? So Rav Malamud says, when you're in power, you have to have native instincts to go right now. And if somebody is not native born, says Rav Malamud, what are your native instincts? What are the most ingrained natural responses culturally? They're not naturally going to be ones you've adopted later in life. So he says maybe that's a concern. Second, he says you have to understand the people. A melech tzarich lahavin et ha'am. You have to understand the people. You have to have your finger on the pulse of the population, especially during a crisis. You have to be able to talk them through. How many times have politicians failed because they've said something that just sounds completely atonal? Like, what do you talk? That's not how the people are feeling. I think actually George Bush had a similar crisis. There was, I can't remember exactly what happened. I was too young, or at least I pretend. I was too young. There was, I think it was in South Carolina, there was major flooding, and he was like in Air Force One looking down, and he said something, and people were like, how, say again?
Hurricane Katrina.
He said something, people said, what are you talking about? People are suffering, and you make some flippant remarks. So you've got to be like attached to the population. And if you're not from this place in a native term, I could never speak to an Israeli public. I didn't grow up there. I haven't faced what they face. I haven't grown up every single day with a sense of existential threat. I can't represent them in that way. In fact, on a separate note, Rabbi Jonathan Sacks, a lot of people said, why didn't, he's the most significant voice of modern Judaism for the last 30 years. Why didn't he make Aliyah, move to Israel? And he felt he can't speak to the people of Israel. He doesn't share that background. And he wouldn't resonate in the same way. They're translating his works, and intellectually he can have a huge influence, but he couldn't step into that role. And thirdly, the Rav Malamed says, part of the position of power is you have to be respected. And for better or worse, we as human beings, and this may come as a surprise, have prejudices. And we feel closer to people who are closer to us or more like us. And if in a time of crisis, the person who is leading me, and we're about to go to war, the person leading me, I don't associate with them, how are they going to inspire me? How are they going to lead a country through crisis? So that's his assumption about position of authority. You want someone who understands you, people who represent you and you associate with, and somebody whose instincts are going to be latent. But I'll finish with the Binyan Av. This is Rav Bakshi Doron. He was the Sephardi chief rabbi of Israel. And he takes an interesting view, with which I think is a helpful way to close out President's Day on a year of a presidential election. He says, firstly, there are two parts to his answer at the bottom of the box, as I said, with which we'll finish. The first part, he says, there is a big difference between leadership and authority. And he says, there is no reason that somebody who is a ger cannot be a leader. There's a ban on authority, that's true. But leadership is open. And I should say, this is a separate discussion, but there are debates about the role of women in Judaism and positions of authority they can have. And this is where he says, you can have, women can be the gadol hador. There may be certain bans on certain institutional authorities, but there's no ban on public leadership, on positions of influence. And this is how he puts it. Nira shigerim yecholim l'shamesh. He says women, and also gerim, can serve kamanhigim afilu gadol hador. They can be, even the gadol hador, like Shmaya Naftalion, were converts, they can be the leading figures in people, shekoach hanakatam, because the power of their leadership is what bequeaths them with authority. And Rabbi Sacks actually has a long piece reflection on this, saying that you can have, if I were to ask you right now, who's got more power? And I don't want to open the floodgates to this. If I said, who's got more power right now, Joe Biden or Donald Trump, I think we could have an interesting debate about who's got more power on the American public. Because I think it's true that Joe Biden has access to buttons that Donald Trump does not. He can launch nuclear weapons. Donald Trump cannot right now. So he's got, in terms of authority, a lot more power. He can direct the armed forces. But if you say, who's got more sway over the public psyche right now? I mean, in terms of who draws more media attention, who drives the pulse of the country more, I think there's an open debate over who's got more power. And what Rabbi Sacks and Rav Bakshi Doron suggest is there is a big difference between authority that is enshrined in institutional power and influence that is enshrined in a position of public leadership. And somebody who is not native born, it is true I can't be president. And it's true that someone who is a ger cannot have a position of authority, but they can have a huge role of leadership and influence. And I think this is the point with which we'll finish. In the last three lines, he says, maybe the reason that we don't allow a ger to serve in position of authority, and the reason I'm not allowed to be president, is not in tension with that first value. It is actually an expression of it. How many people do you know who have entered into politics who have not been attacked? Yeah, correct. I don't mean just physically. I mean verbally attacked. How many people do you know who have entered politics who have not elicited hatred from a segment of the population? No one. You cannot enter the realm of politics without drawing critique and exacerbating hatred. I'm not that plugged into contemporary affairs, but my understanding is Taylor Swift has been in the news in the last few weeks. She's the most popular person on the planet. If she came out today and said, I'm supporting this candidate, she would instantly draw. I mean, she's already, because there are hints and rumors, maybe she's going to support someone. There's a bunch of kind of rousing critique. She hasn't. If she did, she would instantly lose half her fans and become an object of hate for half and an object for love for the other. Politics is a vicious sphere where, and you think about the way we talk about political figures, and I'm including me in this, is how many of us would talk about an 80-year-old person the way we talk about somebody who's that age running in politics? Wouldn't we be more sensitive and compassionate? Would we mock their mental abilities? Would we mock their physical? I mean, it's astonishing what we do. When somebody enters the realm of politics, they become a target. And that's because, it's not because we're cruel, it's because they wield power over us. They make decisions that affect my life and my children and my community and my friends and my family. And when you're making decisions that affect people's lives in a concrete way, you're going to get criticism. And the Binyan Avra Bakshi Doran suggests maybe out of love for the immigrant, we say, you know what, we're not going to let you get into politics. We want, yeah, thank you, thank God. We want to insulate you from that realm of vitriol and hate, because it's tempting. How many, again, I'm relieved of this temptation, but how many of us think, you know, if it wasn't so difficult and you didn't have to raise money, I think I could do a pretty good job. Or I'll run for office, I'll do something, I'll be an authority, or we feel like I could do a better job than they are. In some ways, we think we could resolve it. It's impossible. These decisions always affect somebody badly. And we protect the convert by saying, you know what, we're going to keep you out of that vitriol, and guess what, we're also going to send a message, especially important during the election year. Politics is important. To ignore politics would lead us to peril. Politics has been the source of our persecution for many centuries. So it is important to pay attention. But it is not the only thing that matters. In fact, it's not the most important. What is the most important thing that matters from a Jewish perspective? Not who's the king, but how do I treat my friends? How do I support my family? How do I support my community? How do I shape the future? How do I look out for the weak and the vulnerable? And you know what? If you convert, if you're not native born, you can do all of those things. And that's where you should spend your attention. And it's true, politics has to happen. Somebody has to do it. And it should be the person who's most qualified. But don't idolize politicians. And don't think that's the be-all and end-all. Because the most important role that anyone can play is not to be president or king or queen. The most important role any of us can play is to be a good citizen. And anybody can and should do that. So I wish you all a happy President's Day, which we can rename as Citizens' Day, and I wish you a good year.